Your local radio. Across central southern Dorset.
Keep 106.
You are listening to Ridgeway Magazine with John Shepherd and Andy Fenton.
Just a little loving early in the morning beats a cup of coffee for starting off the day. Just a little loving when the world is yawning makes you wake up feeling good, things are coming your way.
Well, what a year. It's been either a memorable one or one we would rather forget. Take your pick. And talking of picking, it's the voices that makes Ridgeway Magazine. So here is our review of the year through some of the 100 or so people who've contributed to the show with interviews and stories, news and views. Andy and I have been listening to the recordings sitting in Keep 106 Digital Vault and hope you enjoy listening again to the items we've selected. So here goes. Over to you, Andy.
Thank you, John. Well, now, we don't want anyone to accuse us of being party poopers, but we feel the need to air a gentle warning about being careful when pouring drinks at home, and we hope it'll be taken in the right spirit. Almost a year ago, we had a piece of advice which went like this. One drink could put you over the limit. Really? But it's true. We are drinking more at home. Removed from the discipline of the legal pub and restaurant drinks measure, home pouring is where the danger lies. John talks to Simon Henrick of Vehicle Insurers Direct Line, which has more than a passing interest in drinking and driving.
The virus is changing our lives and changing our habits. And we're already seeing that people are smoking more, they're gambling more, and they're drinking more, but in rather a different way. Now, Vehicle Insurer Direct Line has come up with some research, and the message is pretty stark, actually. One drink at home, poured at home, could put you over the limit. Direct Line Simon Henrick is on the phone. Can you explain a little bit more about this research?
Yes, John. We undertook this research. We thought it should be a really good way, rather than just ask people questions as a normal consumer research. We actually got 100 drivers and sent them measuring flasks and asked them when they poured themselves a drink to then pour that into the measuring flask so they could actually see what they were put, the amount they were pouring. It was quite worrying, actually, and I think we probably, it's something we probably all know anyway, that we probably, what we count as a single measure of spirit, we probably pour a little bit more at home, but it's the consequences of that if someone then gets in a car. But, for instance, what we found was 51% of people overpoured 125, what they thought was 125 millilitre glass of wine.
That's a small glass.
Overpour it. Yeah, small glass. And that's probably, even though we would never really recommend drinking and driving in any way, in the sense of, you know, our view on it is very much, if you're going to drink, don't drive. And if you're going to drive, don't drink, I suppose. That's the thing that we like to say. But 125 milliliter glass of wine would probably, you know, keep you under the limit, the legal limit. And what we found was over half of people poured more than 125 millilitres of glass, and 13% poured at least 175 millilitres, and then 5%, so 1 in 20. So of those hundreds, 5 people poured 200 millilitres, thinking it was 125 millilitres. And that may not seem like a big glass of wine to someone, but if you went out and drove after that, you would be over the limit.
I see. So what you're saying is that people are being overgenerous. I mean, that's wine. What about spirits?
Well, what we found with spirits, that actually one in... when we asked people then to pour a spirit, we asked them to pour a single, which is 25 millilitres, for those who don't know. And one in six of those people poured at least a double.
I see.
Double the amount, yeah. And then when we actually asked people to pour a double, yeah, actually two-thirds were pretty much correct. But about a quarter poured at least a treble. So quite a substantial amount of alcohol. And yeah, again, it's home measures are bigger, and and it is that tipple of wine, and then you have to go to the shops or whatever, and you think you're okay, but actually you're not, and the consequences can be awful.
Let's get into the party mood after that somber warning. Some years ago, research into drinking habits revealed that over 95% of us had either sampled or at one time drunk an alcoholic drink which comes in a tiny bottle. Any ideas? Andy has his bottle opener at the ready and will give us the answer.
Now we're going to turn the clocks back with this next Ridgeway magazine item. Makes you feel ancient, doesn't it, when you discover Baby Sham is 65 years old. It was at first called the Genuine Champagne Perry, according to the words on the label. That was until the word champagne was deleted after a very expensive court case in which the French champagne makers objected to the use of their jealously protected name. Baby Sham, the light sparkling perry, that's pear juice, was invented by Francis Showering, a brewer in Shepton Mallet. He and his family made cider and wondered what to do with tons of pears that were harvested locally. At the time, he was experimenting with making fermented fruit juice into alcoholic drinks. Through trial and error, he came up with a sparkling perry drink. It made their fortunes. In the following years, the cash-rich Showerings went on to buy up now-forgotten cider makers like Whiteways in Devon, Coates Cider in Nailsea, near Bristol, and Gamers Cider, which is still going strong with its brand Old English Cider. The story of Baby Sham is almost a story of female emancipation, but without the political element. Bear with me. At a time of social change, it was the right drink at the right time.
So in the 1950s and early 60s, women did not frequent pubs except on rare outing to the saloon bar, and usually accompanied by a husband or boyfriend. Women generally just did not go to pubs. It wasn't that pubs were dangerous or threatening places, but they were male-dominated. Work clothes, darts, dominoes in the smoky public bar, and smart gear in the saloon, where drinks always cost a little more. The other problem was that women did not know what drinks to order. Pubs stocked small bottles of beer, often with pretty foil caps, which were designed for women drinkers. But not every woman liked the taste of beer. Ladies didn't knock back pints of beer. Scotch was an acquired taste, and vodka was thought to be too strong, Russian, and it wasn't very popular with either sex. Now, male partners couldn't really afford gin and the mixer to go with it. There was Juboni and Martini and a fizzy drink called Moussac in a small bottle which looked a little bit like champers. Wine in those days was just not stocked in any but the most expensive bars and hotels and rarely served by the glass. Wine bars didn't appear in the high street until the early 1980s.
So on a night out, down at the local, what was a gal to drink? The choice was limited until along came a small bottle with a baby deer motif, Baby Sham. It eventually took the country by storm and made the Showerings a fortune. In a matter of 3 or 4 years, after the initial launch in Somerset and the West Country in 1953, the drink was repackaged, and a few years later it became a must-have item in practically all Britain's 60,000 pubs and tens of thousands of hotels. When it was launched in 1953, it was originally called Baby Champ, and without the deer. That came later. And we're talking about Baby Sham, which is 65 years old this year. The originators, the Showering family of Shepton Mallet, were at first taken aback by the new drink's success, even though the name was not that appealing. So they sought marketing advice. Enter the London Advertising Agency, which quickly understood the Somerset drink maker's weakness. The family had no idea of how to go about developing the drink as a national brand, and this is where folklore in advertising comes in. The agency repackaged and rebranded the product, calling it Baby Sham, and added that all-important motif, the drawing of the little prancing deer with the smiley eyes and ribbon round its neck. The product became the first alcoholic drink to be advertised on the newly launched commercial television channels in 1957. Sales boomed, and the ad man who thought up the Baby Sham name and rolled out the brand nationally was presented with a gift in appreciation. A Rolls-Royce from the grateful showering family. Coachwork in dazzling white.
In the good old days when your nearest pub was your local and not the glorified eatery it has become today, that's as the pub is still there, of course, the pub snack was a sack of potatoes, and that's London slang for a packet of crisps, a pickled egg, or a packet of Big D peanuts. So, Andy, take us to the public bar and we will join you in a pint. Just the one, because it's not quite the end of the show.
And now the Baby Sham story takes us to the sack of potatoes and Mr. Smith, who gave his name to Smith's crisps. If you think about it, I'll bet not many days go by when you don't see someone with a bag of crisps. Young children in pushchairs being wheeled around supermarkets with crisps as a bribe to keep them quiet. Workmen and office workers on their lunch break, and people travelling on trains, when there are such things between Weymouth and the rest of the world. Then there are crisps adorning the pub meal. And would you believe there are some people who mistakenly think the crisps count as part of the five-a-day intake of vegetables. I don't believe it. Well, anyway, now for the fascinating facts. I don't know who compiles these statistics, but who is to argue that those of us who are habitual crisp eaters consume 178 packets a year? If that's an average figure, it means some people eat more than that. The favourite flavours, in order of preference, are, in first place, cheese and onion, second, salt and vinegar, and third, ready salted. So, where did it all start? In America, where the crisp is called a chip, and where chips in the UK are called also fries, whether French or otherwise. The story goes that the potato crisp, it's simpler if we call it that, was the result of a row between a very rich man called Cornelius Vanderbilt and a chef. While dining in an expensive restaurant in New York, he complained his chips were too thick and sent them back to the kitchen. The chef, a Mr. Crumb, was insulted, and his response was to slice a potato so thin with the result it emerged from the fat cooked to a crisp. Old Corny, a railroad tycoon, loved them. Well, that was in 1853, and nothing much happened for the next 70 years, although scholars of works by Charles Dickens will be ringing Keep 106 to tell us that in his book The Tale of Two Cities, he refers to husky chips of potatoes.
Well, there's a thing. Mm. It seems all went quiet on the crunchy crisp front until a Mr. Scudder began selling crisps in California. He had the bright idea of selling crisps in wax paper sealed with an iron to keep them fresh and prevent them from crumbling. Another food entrepreneur took the idea a step further and began selling freshly cooked crisps from the boot of his car. Then came the ruffled, crinkle-cut variety of crisp. And I often wondered why, but apparently the crinkle cutting, and say that in a hurry, the crinkle cutting process actually makes the crisp stronger and less prone to being crushed. Well, who'd have thought it? Now, flavoured crisps were an American invention by a foodie called Joe Spud Murphy. The first two flavours were, unsurprisingly, salt and vinegar and cheese and onion. And, of course, they're still with us. Meanwhile, in England, the American story is challenged with the pages of a cookbook with a recipe for what were called potato shavings cooked in lard. It was published by, well before Chef Crumb was born. So there, the Brits were first, and at one time, though, would you believe it, there were 800 crisp makers in Britain. Now it's time to introduce Frank Smith.
Now, Smith took up the idea and found a disused garage in North London and produced crisps on a commercial scale, selling them to pubs locally at a time when the potato crisp was just about the only food item available behind the bar. He raised enough money with two friends to fund the business properly, and within 6 months he had 12 employees producing 500,000 packets a year. 10 years later, he had 10 factories producing 100 million packets a year. All went well until the 1970s, when along came Golden Wonder, the name of a variety of potato the company used, which stole half the market from Smith's. The secret was in the packaging. Smith's crisps went off in natural light and were kept in large tins. Walker's new packaging allowed their products to be displayed on countertops without risk of spoiling, and it proved the rule that seeing is buying. Smith's got their packaging right and retaliated by reintroducing the bag of salt with a product called Salt and Shake. The vogue at the time was for nostalgia, and the once familiar salt bag was a winner, but not enough to recapture the 95% of the crisp market Smith's had once enjoyed.
So, I mean, that bag of salt was magic for Smith's, but in my local supermarket, and you may think I've got nothing better to do, but I counted 38 different types of potato crisps. Salt is still the big thing. All sorts of salt. You can choose from lightly salted crisps, sea salt, crushed sea salt, uncrushed sea salt, salt and sherry, salt and balsamic vinegar, salt with apple. But anyway, let's delve into the realms of the more exotic crisp, which includes such flavour as Gressingham duck with plum sauce and spicy onion, white Stilton and cranberry relish crisps, peppered bullseye steak crisps, chicken oh my Josh. Now, there's crisp for pigs in blankets, and there's German tomato and mozzarella crisps, and a variety offering a powerful Welsh rabbit flavour. Or should that be rabbit?
Now, a complete change of topic. Among the many guests we invited onto the show, one has stuck in our minds. In March, Martin Underhill retired as the Dorset Police and Crime Commissioner. Because of the issues caused in the county by the pandemic and its ramifications, he was asked to stay in post for an extra year, making 9 years of service in addition to the 30 years he'd spent as a police officer. At the end of his tenure, he gave Ridgeway magazine a hard-hitting interview. It's interesting to note that the concerns of a year ago with regard to policing and the public are still with us today, and he refers to occasions of civil unrest.
Do we know what people want the police to be? Because, I mean, policing, I think, is right to say, is at a crossroads at the moment. I mean, there's so much going on. For instance, you know, the COVID passport, there's the right to protest, Black Lives Matter, the business, as you pointed out, of statues, people boarding them up, or people graffitiing statues. I mean, there is an awful lot going on.
There is an awful lot going on, and I am sad. We didn't know this was going to happen, did we? But I'm sad to leave at the time I'm leaving, because I would say about 3 months ago, I wouldn't have said that. But I'm sad to be leaving at the moment because of transition in a senior politician overseeing the police at the time when we really don't know what's happening every day. These are really uncertain times, and it's very rare that society has four or five tectonic plates moving together at the same time. And that's what we've got. We've got the anti-COVID movement. We've got Black Lives Matter. We've got the Sarah Everard whole issue of safety for women and violence against women and girls. We've got the summer, and we've got a disaffected population, because about probably 25% of that population will lose their jobs over COVID at some stage. All of that leads to a really worried police crime commissioner, a really worried chief constable. This is a very worrying summer.
In my newspaper today is full of COVID passports. I mean, having the knowledge that you have, do you think something like that would work, and how would it work?
No, it won't, because it's all very well saying you have to have a COVID passport to go for a drink or go to the theatre. It completely misses the point, John. There are people, and we don't know the figures, do we, but in my head I would reckon 1 in 20 people after this lockdown, third or fourth lockdown, are now suffering from agoraphobia. There are many people I know who will not leave the house. they are so institutionalised because of the last year, particularly if they were told to shield by the NHS, which many were, that they don't want to go out. And that's why they're not going for a vaccination. That doesn't make them a bad person. It doesn't mean they shouldn't be able to engage in social activity once they get brave enough to leave their house. And the other reason I don't agree with the vaccination passport is we know the take-up of vaccinations is much lower in the black and ethnic minority groups for various reasons, some political, some religious, some lifestyle. And what you're doing is saying to people from the BAME community, you can't go to the pub, you can't go to the cinema because you haven't complied and had your jab. I think it's a really dangerous precedent. And, of course, who's going to pick up the pieces from that?
Oh, exactly.
The police force is already in policing deficit. There's already facing enormous violence from all of the different conflicting agendas I've already mentioned. And then you bring the police in to ask someone from a pub because they haven't got a certificate saying they've got a vaccine. The world is literally going mad. I think we have to take a breath and calm down because Dorset has got just over 1,200 police officers. That isn't very many. And we, you know, the police does not have the ability or the sustainability to police the way out of this. It's just wrong. And I do worry. I worry a lot about this summer, not just locally, but regionally. You've seen what's happening in Bristol. And there are various flashpoints in this country that we've seen historically many signs. South London, Manchester, Liverpool, and Bristol have all sadly got the stamp of civil disorder on their history many times. And I fear that's what's going to happen.
Would you,
I know it sounds all very depressing, but you know, your listeners, hopefully your listeners know what I'm saying. It's a huge ask for a police force that polices by consent to police their way out of this. It really is a huge ask. And the European countries that are doing this don't have the same issue because they don't police by consent. They carry huge batons, they carry guns, they have water cannon that we don't have. You know, they police disorder, they police the public in such a different way that they frankly don't care about this. They're just doing their job and they'll go in and enforce it. It isn't how British policing works, and it's quite worrying.
I suppose you could say that are the police the kind of focal point for the public's frustrations at the moment?
Yeah, very much so. And if you look at what happened in Bristol last weekend and the serious injuries officers sustained, people are attacking the police almost as if, you know, vent their anger on society, take it out on the police, which of course is what happened in the Brixham riots and various other Tottenham riots and various other disorders, Toxteth. That is what happens. But you've got to remember that unlike Toxteth, Brixham and the others, this is a police force, just like the NHS, that is exhausted. This is a police force that's policed the COVID for a year. And this is an NHS that's policed a pandemic for a year. The NHS hasn't got much resilience left, and neither has policing. And to put policing into a summer-long period of civil disorder is deeply worrying because, you know, the police are tired.
That was former Police and Crime Commissioner Martin Underhill. It's gardening time now. We have our gardening expert Ruth Hayes from Amateur Gardening Magazine to thank for her regular contributions throughout the year. And here is a serious matter, particularly for gardeners in the Dorchester area.
Topic today is knotweed.
Hello. Japanese knotweed, yes.
Well, first of all, what is it, where did it come from, and how do you recognise it?
Right, so Japanese knotweed, along with things like Himalayan balsam and rhododendrons, were brought in by the Victorians. They went off, they did their exploring, you know, and they brought it back because they thought it was a nice, attractive plant that would look good in English gardens. And funnily enough, when my magazine Amateur Gardening was founded back in 1835, the then editor actually wrote an article praising Japanese knotweed, because people loved it. You know, it's attractive. It's a statuesque plant, but it's also an absolute menace.
Now, I've never seen it, so can you describe it?
Yeah, of course. It's it dies right back in winter, but in spring, these little red and purple shoots will appear at ground level with crimsony pink, dark pink buds, and these stems will grow up into sort of stands of, they almost look like bamboo, and they can be up to 2 meters, 7 foot tall. And then it starts putting out leaves, and the leaves are large. They can be about 5 inches long. They're heart-shaped or shovel-shaped. They're green. And then in sort of late summer and early autumn, they produce tassels of pretty white flowers that grow to about 6 inches or 15 centimeters long. And they die back again in winter. And the thing is with knotweed is it's an absolute devil to get rid of. And it also looks like several other fairly innocuous garden climbers, such as Russian vine and Himalayan honeysuckle. But it isn't. You can tell what it is by the way it dies back, by the shape of the leaves, and by these creamy flower tassels in late summer and early autumn.
So sadly, it's rather pretty, is it?
Unfortunately, yes. Yes, it is. Well, if you like that sort of thing, yes, you know, it's. But it is so invasive, yes.
Now, yeah. Why is it so alarming? I mean, I read in the local newspaper that there was incidences of knotweed in Dorchester and also, I think, in Lyme Regis. So why is it so dangerous?
Right. The two main things about it are it grows incredibly rapidly. It spreads underground on rhizomes, the sort of underground roots.
So it will spring up anywhere, will it?
Sorry?
It will spring up anywhere in your garden once it's there,
it will come in from next door's garden. But also, the smallest piece of it, if you're getting rid of it, or ideally, which we could talk about later, you should get professionals in to deal with it. If the smallest bit is left behind, dropped on the ground, it will regenerate. And it's so powerful. I mean, there have been stories of it coming up through newly built, you know, through the floors and walls of newly built conservatories and things, you know. It's that powerful and that invasive.
Now, there is a legal aspect to all this, isn't there?
There's a massive legal aspect. There's legal regulations with getting rid of it, and if you have it in your garden, there are legal implications about selling your house, buying a house with it. It's become a major issue since about 2013. It was made law that if you're selling your house and you know you've got it in your garden, you've got to declare it. And if your buyer, isn't aware of it, and then it becomes obvious that there is knotweed, the mortgage lender may not guarantee the money. So it is a big problem. You need to get rid of it.
So I see. So there is a legal implication then?
If you sell
your house until presumably you get rid of it?
Yes, there is. And it is also illegal if you've tried to get it out of your garden yourself. It is illegal to just dump it somewhere. It's illegal to fly tip it. It's illegal to fly tip anything. And you should never put it in your green waste bin or your compost or your house waste bin. You should take it to a licensed landfill site.
So with all those implications, I think you better just repeat very quickly what it looks like.
Right. It appears in spring from purpley red shoots that have crimson buds. It grows fast and tall into these bamboo-like stands of stems that can be about 2 meters tall. The leaves are heart-shaped, quite large, about 5 inches long, and it has creamy flower tassels in late summer and autumn. And then it dies back again in winter.
As we hunker down in front of the fire, grateful for the fact that so far it's been a relatively mild winter, let's return to the summer. How's this for a bit of Ridgeway Magazine whimsy, as we invited listeners to keep cool in the heat wave we experienced for a few glorious days last summer? Who needs the costas when his hoss are at home? That's what the tabloids always trumpet, isn't it?
It's flaming July. Do you feel the heat when it's hot? And what should you do to relieve the effects of the rays upon your person? Well, here are some ideas worth trying, some more worthy than others. Take a cold hot water bottle to bed. Works like a dream. Fill a sock with rice grains, a clean sock preferably, not rice pudding. Place it in the freezer until frozen, then take it out and rub it all over your hot spots. If rice pudding is used, be sure to cook once it's thawed. Put cold water on your wrists, or soak your wrists in a basin of cold water. An ice cube in the crook of your arm also works. Don't buy a designer moisturiser full of expensive designer water, like Evian. Instead, go to your nearest pound shop, buy a spray, fill it with ice-cold tap water, and use it as a homemade moisturiser. If you live in Weymouth or Dorchester, pay no heed to the limescale content. The water is perfectly safe to use on the face in moderation, experts assure us, and it will not clog your pores. Should pores become blocked, a medical version of WD-40 is recommended. Consult a pharmacist rather than an ironmonger.
More cooling ideas. Have some fun with the kiddiewinkies. Turn on the lawn sprinklers or put the children in a paddling pool, and when they're dripping wet, give them a cuddle. With luck, they will be cold, but not dangerously so. Handy hint, best not to be wearing your best clothes at the time you're giving them a wet cuddle. Shopping. On a hard day, seek relief in a supermarket with huge chiller or freezer cabinets. Open the doors and stand in front of them and take your time in selecting produce. Do not rub frozen items over yourself in the store, as it might cause offence. But if you do this in store, best purchase semi-thawed products for use at home later. Do not refreeze, and out of respect for other customers, do not replace the item in the freezer cabinet. And on the subject of walk-in freezers, relief may be gained, but be certain you can leave safely and that there is an alarm system should egress be denied. Always seek permission first, and do not do this unaccompanied, even on the hottest days. Take mobile in case of difficulty. Simpler relief from heat in the home may be achieved by opening all the doors and windows early in the morning. 5 a.m. is a good time. Open windows and doors, keep blinds and curtains closed during the day, and a good idea is to open the loft hatch. This is done on the principle heat rises, thus the top of the house will become cooler. And finally, if all else fails, move to northeast Scotland.
During the year, the Dorset Echo celebrated its 100th birthday, although we have to admit that in its long life in bringing us the news, the newspaper was not always called the Echo. For 29 of those years, Harry Walton was its chief reporter, and we invited him to remind listeners about some of the stories he's covered that made the headlines.
Tell us one that you really remember.
Well, when I was there, I actually won an award for writing 1,000 front page leads, which I still got the printing plate from up in the loft somewhere. But one of the ones that struck me from memory as being perhaps the most dramatic that I covered or was involved with for a while was the death of the captain of HMS Osprey when his helicopter went into a breakwater. We didn't know anything about that at the time, but one of our staff members lived out at Preston, and she rang the news desk up and said, it's probably nothing, but there isn't half a big bonfire out towards Portland Way, big pall of smoke. So I said, oh, yeah. So we thought, well, it's probably out somewhere not far from the base out there, which was HMS Osprey. So we rang around and we couldn't get anything. And we reached a point where somebody got through to the base and that the phone just rang. We knew it was the right number, so because we got contact numbers in those days for all the base main personnel. And no one answered, and no one answered, and no one answered. And then suddenly, a breathless voice came as the phone was picked up. Yes? And we say, I can't stop. So the base commander's just flown into the breakwater and put the phone down. And of course, quite a lot of things hit the fan then, and everybody was rushing around like blazes trying to chase the story down. And we wound up with quite a major story, to say the least.
So this is a helicopter, was it?
Yes, yes it was. He was actually the pilot. It's so long ago, I can't remember his name. I think his name was Wigley, possibly. It rings a bell from a long time ago. But it was a terrible incident, because, of course, he was very well known and liked. And 1 minute he was there, and the next gone.
Now, another story, I can remember this one, was when a container ship fetched up. Where did that happen? It was beached, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was put onto the shore or beached, whatever term you choose to use, and essentially it had an awful lot of goods on it in containers, and it was obviously known as the container bonanza, if you like, because there was everything you could possibly think of in these containers, from brand new BMW motorbikes to case after case of cigarettes. And of course, when these things started breaking free and beginning to float up onto the shore, people used to walk the tide line, and you could pick up, literally without any exaggeration, I went down there long after most of it had been picked up, and I was still picking up 20 packets, 30 packets, 40 packets of cigarettes.
And you were...
In a space of 50 yards.
You were drying them out, were you? Now, what we haven't said is this was 2007. Where did it happen?
I'm not actually... From memory, I mean, it was further up the coast towards Bridport, Burton, Bradstock, around there. I can't remember the exact location. It was in the... You know, it wasn't an easy place to get to, but of course one of the problems came was when they were trying to save the thing, and there was all questions of salvage and like that. And then of course once they began to wake up to exactly what was washing ashore, there was a hasty attempt to stop people from hauling all sorts of things, because people were, some of these BMW bikes went missing. But
it sounds like Dorset's its own whiskey galore.
You are listening to Ridgeway Magazine on Keep 106 with John Shepherd and Andy Venton.
On Keep 106, we would not be doing our job if we didn't treat some subjects seriously and give warnings when and where necessary. This is an issue we aired in the summer months, and we called the subject Killer Cows, following an incident in which a woman was seriously injured while out for a country walk. Andy takes up the story.
Witnesses say woman lucky to be alive after she is attacked by livestock in a field. Beneath it was a photo of an air ambulance that had first of all landed in the same field as the cows, shown in the background of the picture published on the front page. The woman had been trampled, was badly injured and covered in muck. Fortunately, her cries for help were heard by people in a nearby public car park, and the cows were seen off only to apparently have a go at the air ambulance, which had to lift off and land elsewhere. There can't be many cases where a herd of cows have taken on a noisy helicopter. The background to the story is important to folk who don't live in the country or have no experience of country ways. Fact. Since 2010, 98 people have been killed by cattle in the UK. Of these, 22 were members of the public, the rest being either farmers or farm workers. Last year, 2 farmers were killed. The matter is urgent enough for the National Farmers Union to put out an official warning. This was widely reported last year following the death of a schoolteacher who was trampled to death by cows while walking his dogs along a public footpath. The tragic incident shows that using a footpath that runs through a field of cows is no guarantee of safety. That's where most accidents happen. It goes without saying that cows can be spooked by unruly dogs, and one frightened cow can transform a peaceful herd into an angry mob. Cows will follow their leader, and there's always one leading cow in a herd. If it decides to attack, the rest will follow and inflict death or injury through sheer numbers. An important point to recognise is that cows will protect calves. So always avoid fields where there are calves and never ever get between a calf and its mother.
The advice for dog walkers is to keep all dogs on a lead, even when a path is regularly used by the public. If cows should show too much of an interest by moving towards you, let the dog off the lead. This is the first step in your own survival. The cows are more likely to follow the dog than its owner, as the dog is the threat to the herd, not necessarily the human. Stuart Roberts, Deputy Chairman of the NFU, National Farmers Union, told the Guardian newspaper, "Generally, dogs will outrun cattle. There are things everyone should remember. The classic is walkers getting between cows and calves. Keep dogs on a lead, but if your dog is being threatened by cows, let it go." He also stressed that walkers should resist the temptation to run. "It's almost counterintuitive," he said, "but it is safest to move slowly. If you run, cows will chase you. Move slowly and steadily." Dairy cattle are considered to be more volatile than beef cattle, and farmers are banned by the Health and Safety Executive from keeping certain breeds where there are public footpaths and rights of way. Bulls are banned from these areas too, unless accompanied by cows or heifers, which are a calming influence on them. Farmers can be heavily fined if they contravene this rule, and there has been an incident in which someone has been injured, and flouting the rule can cost one Cornish farmer, or rather has cost a Cornish farmer, a £20,000 fine.
And one final point, keeping an eye on other people's dogs. A rampaging herd may not be selective when it comes to dog ownership. They might go for any walker, dog or no dog. Look for a way out of a field and be prepared to scramble through a hedge or jump a fence. Cows may not fear a roaring helicopter, but there's no record of a cow jumping a fence, as far as we know. Now, here's a fascinating fact. Despite the number of cows being called buttercup, did you know they do not, or rather cannot, eat them? Along with most farm animals, they're poisonous. They cause mouth blisters, and intestinal problems will kill cows. Well now, how we all love lists. 70 years or so after it was published, it was reported that the novel 1984 by George Orwell topped the list of the top-selling classical books. So much in the novel about a repressed and fearful society where history was rewritten to suit those that governed seems to be coming true today. We asked historian and author Paul Atterbury to talk about 1984.
Paul, what's your take on 1984, remembering that the first line is absolutely incredible, "The clock struck 13. Who could resist reading further?
Exactly. I mean, it really gets you into it. The world has changed in that book. I think a bit of background. I mean, Orwell starts out in the 1930s, really, as a conventional socialist. He fights in Spain and he writes Homage to Catalonia. And that in that are the seeds of his disillusionment with communism and the realization of the world that represented. We get Animal Farm, which of course takes that idea further in a more comic way, and his final book before his death is of course 1984, and the title itself is confusing in a sense that actually, if you and I remember 1984, which wasn't that long ago but long enough ago, nothing Orwellian had really happened. So everybody said, oh, he got it wrong, you know, he could pick the wrong year. Some people say that 1984 was simply a reversion of 1948. He wanted originally to call it that, but everybody said, his publisher says, no, you know, that's much too soon. But I think the context now is, of course, as the years go by, we've got nearer and nearer to that dystopian, to use that word, sort of futuristic.
Is that ever quite sure what dystopian means?
Well, I think I hadn't looked it up either, but it's sort of destructive futurism. You know, it's a vision of the world that none of us want to be part of, but and yet is inevitable.
Increasingly we are, aren't we?
Yes. And I think Orwell has much greater relevance now, 70 years on, than he did actually in 1984.
It's about the power of the state, isn't it?
It's about the power of the state. It's also about, as you said at the beginning, the complete realignment and rearrangement of what we consider to be words like history, truth, love, relationships, freedom, independence. You know, all these things change in a dystopian environment. And of course there are a number of books that have done it, but I think it's very relevant that we've just seen the publication of Margaret Atwood's Testament, following up on The Handmaid's Tale, which is again another vision of the way our world could be very, very easily. We're on the edge of, apart from extinction, which we're certainly on the edge of, we're merging and wandering and rather carelessly moving towards, I think, this dystopian future.
I mean, Orwell gave us all sorts of titles, really. He gave us The Thought Police.
Newspeak.
Newspeak, yes.
You know, there's about 10 or 12 words currently in our language, not least Orwellian, that all relate to 1984.
So we're thinking, well, actually, in the book, the vocabulary is being rewritten, isn't it? So there's no such thing as bad, it's ungood.
Yes.
So good becomes either plus good or double plus good.
Yeah. And that's about positivism. You know, we'll make people feel good about what is happening. And his job is to rewrite history, to make sure that the history of the past can be resubsumed and recreated to fulfil the beliefs of the current regime.
Now, there are some very dark things that he introduces. The 2 minutes hate. Of course, we must remember every dwelling had a screen.
Yep.
So Big Brother could watch you all the time.
Yes.
And one of the ways that Orwell, or rather our hero Winston Smith, got away from Big Brother was by writing a diary, which was totally forbidden, because he found a corner in his room where the screen could not reach him.
Yes.
Where he could not be seen.
Well,
but then we've got screens with cameras in them now.
Yes. I mean, I think what Orwell did not see is a very, very significant thing, which is that our route to that type of future is being taken by us very voluntarily, because it actually comes through the internet. Things like social media have actually opened up everybody's private lives to inspection. You know, if I was running a totalitarian regime, all I've got to do is look at Facebook and Twitter, and I know exactly what everybody is doing. Back that up with cameras, CCTV everywhere. Then we're already nearly there, but the strange thing is we've got there not by state imposition, but by a curious pursuit of the internet for our own indulgence. I mean, the most dangerous things we have, really, are social media. Everybody has to accept, and most people don't, that everything you do electronically is read by other people. And whether it's the CIA or GCHQ, it doesn't matter. There is no such thing as a private email unless you encode it in a very complicated way. Now, people like me, I have nothing to hide. I don't care who reads my emails. But young people particularly expose themselves in every sense on social media. And that is all logged. You know, when they're applying for a job in 20 years, out it'll all come. Oh, no. You know, when you were 12, you said this. Therefore, you're not acceptable for this job.
So how close was Orwell getting then?
I think he was getting very close. He couldn't anticipate the internet. He didn't know that's what was going to happen. I mean, he was absolutely right, I think, in the way it's going. You know, what is truth? You know, our current generation of politicians are completely changing the meaning of the word truth as we understand it. It's a tenuous concept, I accept, but fake news is completely Orwellian. This is something I don't agree with, therefore it's fake news. And even though the evidence is all there that it isn't fake news, if the great leader, the dear leader, says it is fake news, the world accepts it as fake news. You know, we're in a terribly risky situation, I think, at the moment.
I mean, unfortunately, there isn't one Big Brother at the moment, but I suspect there are a lot of Big Brothers. Take China, for instance.
Well, take China, take North Korea. You know, North Korea is a classic Orwellian state. You know, the dear leader, people manipulated in a way that they seem to be happy, but they're not. No escape. Everything you do, monitored and watched. You know, that is a model based on 1984, as I see it.
And there's a frightening thing that I've read recently about Chinese children in class. They are being watched, and the artificial intelligence can actually measure their brainwaves to see if they are concentrating on the lesson.
But that's an obvious example. You do every time you go to the supermarket, your buying patterns are analysed, and that is then logged as to the sort of person you are, the sort of things you want. Now, this is just commerce and advertising, but it's just the same. You know, whether you buy a particular brand of breakfast cereal, a particular brand of dog food, is all noted by artificial intelligence. So there's a pattern, there's a profile of you or me logged in a supermarket somewhere.
Frightening. Now, let's go back to the book, because, in fact, he had the Ministry of Truth, which was involved in rewriting history. There was the Ministry of Love, which I think was responsible for law and order. And also the Ministry of Peace,
which was the War Office, in effect. So everything is turned on its head. And I think, as I say, you'll see that I'm very negative, but I do see that, you know, in our manipulation of concepts like truth, we're well on the way down that road. I think the hope is, and I think in most cases, as you're right, that as human beings, we're incredibly inefficient and bungling. And most totalitarian states fail sooner or later through internal dramas, conflicts, or by sheer incompetence. And that is the great hope for the future, that we are actually, as a race, hopeless and careless and muddled and unpredictable. And that can save us, I think.
While we were all being persuaded to go green, there is scepticism among many who wonder just how green our country is becoming. With tongue firmly in cheek, Francis reads The Green Thing. And one is bound to wonder if there are a few grains of truth in her reading.
Yesterday, after shopping in our local supermarket, I was in the queue at the checkout and heard when the young cashier suggested to the much older lady that she should bring her own grocery bags because plastic bags are not good for the environment. The woman apologised to the young girl and then sighed, "We didn't have this green thing back in my earlier days." The young clerk responded, "That's our problem today. You folk didn't do enough to save our environment for future generations." The older lady said, "Ah, yes, you're right. Our generation didn't have the green thing in its day." She sighed and then continued, "Back then, we returned milk bottles, lemonade bottles and beer bottles to the shops. The shops then sent them back to the plant to be washed, sterilised and refilled, so these same bottles were used over and over, thus really were recycled. But we didn't have the green thing back in our day. Grocery stores put our groceries into brown paper bags that we reused for numerous things. Most memorable was the use of brown paper bags as book covers for our school books. This was to ensure that public property, that is, the books provided for our use by the school, were not defaced by our scribblings. Then we were able to personalise our books on their brown cover, or covers, or paper bag covers, but too bad we didn't do the green thing back then. I remember how we walked upstairs because we didn't have an escalator in every store or office building, walked to the grocery store and didn't climb into a 300 horsepower machine every time we had to go 200 yards. But she was right. We didn't have the green thing in our day. Back then, we washed the baby's nappies because we didn't have the throwaway kind. We dried clothes on a line, not in an energy gobbling machine burning up 220 volts. Wind and solar power really did dry our clothes back in our days. Kids got hand-me-down clothes from their brothers or sisters, not always brand new clothing. But that young lady is right. We didn't have the green thing back in our day. Back then, we had one radio in the house, not a television in every room. And if anyone did own a TV. It had a small screen the size of a handkerchief, if you remember those, not a screen the size of a football pitch. When cooking, we blended and stirred by hand because we didn't have electric machines to do everything for us. When we packaged a fragile item to send by post, we used layers of old newspaper to cushion it, not styrofoam or plastic bubble wrap. Back then, we didn't fire up an engine or burn gasoline just to cut the lawn. We used a push mower that ran on human power. We exercised by working, so we didn't need to go to a health club to run on treadmills that operate on electricity. But she's right, we didn't have the green thing back then. We drank from a tap or fountain when we were thirsty, instead of using a cup or a plastic bottle every time we had a drink of water. We refilled writing pens with ink instead of buying a new pen, and we replaced the razor blade in a razor instead of throwing away the whole razor just because the blade got dull. But we didn't have the green thing back then. Back then, people took the bus and kids rode bikes to school or walked instead of turning their mothers into a 24-hour taxi service in the family's expensive car or van, which cost what a whole house did before the green thing. Oh, and we had one electrical outlet in a room, not an entire bank of sockets to power a dozen appliances. And we didn't need a computerized gadget to receive a signal beamed from satellites 23,000 miles out in space in order to find the nearest leisure center. But it's so sad this current generation laments how wasteful we old folks were just because we didn't have the green thing back then. I think you should forward this on to another selfish old person who needs a lesson in conservation from some smart young person. We don't like being old in the first place, so it doesn't take much to really annoy us, especially from a tattooed, multiple-pierced, smart aleck who can't make change without the cash register telling them how much.
Thank you, Francis. And that's the end of our pick of 2021. In the next programme, the first in the new year, we'll remember some more of the items we broadcast this year on Ridgeway Magazine, and we'll look forward to the new year and discover some of the memorable anniversaries. So, see you then. But for now, from John and Andy, cheerio.